is as a professor at the University of Minnesota in Lawrence. I am not a physician. I have a PhD and I'm a medical ethicist by orientation, I guess, to what I teach, and nonetheless, I've worked in clinical medicine for a very long time. I also work as a clinical ethicist, a consulting ethicist in the hospitals, have ethics meetings, or that sort of stuff, as well as being a chaplain and ordained in the Episcopal tradition. So I bring a lot of threads together that I share with many of you. This particular research, I was pulled into with my colleague, Charles Gessert, to learn some more about the ethical issues around dialysis and the decision whether or not to continue dialysis. We were very interested in how the decision-making happens around the critical times of whether or not to continue with dialysis, and thinking that we would learn a lot about the narrative and the interaction between doctor and patient, all of that sort of thing, is where we were going. And as we pursued this, I'm going to have to get where I can change the station here. There was some background first. Are many of you familiar with renal end-stage disease? In the U.S., there are 500,000 patients every year, and 350,000 of them are on dialysis. So they're tethered to the dialysis process at least 3 days a week for more than half a day and literally half of their life. A quarter of them die each year. And a quarter of those who do die are electing to go off of dialysis, knowing they will be dead within 10 days. It's projected that the numbers of those who are going to be dying of end-stage renal disease is going to be going up astronomically as we move into the age where there are more and more of us who are elders and more of us who have diabetes and other diseases that are hard on kidneys. Our particular location within the U.S. has twice as many people who make an active decision to end dialysis before they die with kidney disease. And that was one of the reasons we wondered, what's going on here? What's the conversation? Whether it's a cultural, whether it is something our physicians are enabling, describing, allowing, desiring, where is this coming from? As well as just a remarkable opportunity to have conversation with people at the very end of their lives. The research that's been done in the past has indicated that this is a highly individualized decision influenced by the usual words, culture, religion, family, personal stuff, and also has been observed as an existential problem. And the predictive models that have been put together using statistical analysis have not been helpful. And for that reason, it just begs for qualitative work. We have to go to listening. What's going on here? Let's have a conversation. And this offered us that opportunity. We selected in our sample to talk with people who were over the age of 70, people who had been on dialysis for 6 months or more, so they had adapted into the routine and the process that it goes with. And we met with them as they were making decisions, and if they were not able to have conversation, we met with family members as well. The interviews were done at a location of their choice. They were in homes. All of them chose to be at home. We offered to do it at the dialysis centers too, but they chose homes. Three of us were involved in the analysis. Myself is listed there as a sociologist, my physician friend who happens to be a pediatrician, and a nurse who's worked in the renal area before. All of you familiar with qualitative work? Mm-hmm. Okay. So it was the usual. Do the interviews I'll speak more of the methodology in a minute. We had 27 dialysis patients with 31 interviews. 21 interviews were with the dialysis patients, 10 were with family members. And the patient's mean age was 70, there were 15 males and 12 females, and the patients were all white. Please.
You need something, are you?
Black bag.
Okay. And of those who were, is it over there on the chair? There were 15 of the 18 who described themselves as spiritual. Three did not, and the others, we did not use another's opinion of whether or not they were spiritual. We just went with their own opinion as reported here. Let me go back just to the methodology. We did record all of the interviews as they happened. They were transcribed. The three of us listened to all of the tapes. Welcome.
Hello.
We listened to all of the tapes and began our coding with that process, listening for what we thought would be important variables. Then we mapped, reconciled those, and then we went back and started coding the various transcripts and moved from there into from the knowns to the themes and from there into the conversation. I specifically, after we looked at the ethics material, was very interested in quality of life dimension because I've done a lot of research in quality of life area, and I was specifically looking for something called response shift, which is how quality of life, the answers to questions about a person's quality of life shift as something inside of us changes. And I was hoping to be able to document some of that. I did find that. I have reported that as well. But the piece that then startled me was that the process of response shift was happening, but the reasoning people were using for that shift was spiritual and religious. And that was the vocabulary they were using as they explained to me and to us about the changes that were happening to them. The religious themes and practices were relative then to their medical decision-making. Those involved and included their faith-based beliefs as well as the meaning that came from that belief, and I ferreted those apart. Their religious themes and practices were very integral to their coping, and especially the practice piece as well as the community support piece were integral there. And I heard stories about spiritual pain. And this was very real pain. This wasn't distress. This was active pain, and I'll give the examples that come with that. I would offer that as much as I am based and stand on the rock of my own belief system and faith, my colleague is an avowed atheist. And so this conversation, as it emerged from our findings, Charles kept me very honest, just as I kept him honest as we moved through this. But you can rest assured nothing is overspoken on the basis of what the findings are here. So, the beliefs. How did they integrate into the dialysis? They saw dialysis and explained it as one of God's gifts. God gave people the wisdom to do things, and so I believe this is from God. I believe that if we are living God's will, there isn't always just one choice that's right, and that extends into medical choices, too. From a faith standpoint, I see dialysis as life support. From a faith standpoint, I don't have any problem taking away life support. There was also a very strong theme that the beliefs supported that there would be a time to die. And there wasn't any trouble talking about end of life among this cohort of people. And they explained it in a variety of ways. It's listed up there. You can see the third one is son's comment about his mother. I think she was tired out and she was done. She was ready to go. But basically, the second one, I think our view is that when your life is over, it should be over, and then it's time to go to heaven. What comes after death is also very belief-based and explained. It doesn't bother me. I still believe in my church, and I feel that I'm going somewhere better, hopefully. And I'll use the last one. my mother and I have talked many times about faith and heaven and spirituality. I think there's no question in her mind she will be joined again with her dad, my dad, and watch for our little boy, watch him for us until we can be there. So there is a sense of place, a sense of almost longing. I'm just looking forward to going there. Hello, welcome. So how did their beliefs offer meaning to what was happening? The meaning for all of end-stage renal disease experiences was grounded in their beliefs about God's role in their continued survival and in their dying. I'm sorry? 5 minutes left or to go? Done. Okay, fine. We're in good shape. Thank you. So meaning, something that we've heard repeatedly from the podium already in these days together as a consequence or a reason for our belief system in our lives. And it felt that their beliefs about God's role in their survival and their dying were very clear. I think that's the blessing. With most things that happen, there is what you do with it. I'm not very orthodox in my religious views, but it doesn't stop me from saying thank you for the expected wonderful, unexpected wonderful things that have happened. Well, I think it strengthened my belief in God and my reliance on God and my overall outlook on life. God cries with us in our sorrows that he is there to ask for strength. And again, the meaning that God blessed her with more good years when we were able to do a lot of things with her. That was, again, death time of daughter, anticipating the death of her mother, who wasn't able to talk anymore. Meaning also was the basis, spiritual basis, in whether to continue or discontinue the dialysis. And there are times when it was both and, I don't know what I'm going to do, it's both good and it's bad. And then there was the issue of fear and where meaning from their faith base fit with that. Can you see any connection between your faith and your decision or your attitude towards dialysis? Dialysis is part of my life. It's not against my religion to give up. My faith is strong. It's also not against your religion to have dialysis. No, it's not. Fear. The bottom one. Let me ask about how religion, how your faith has helped you with all of this. Patient, yeah, I'm not scared at all. But I still want to live. And then the one before that, I have no worries about it, not at all. Yeah, if you have faith, there's nothing to fear. No fear of death. So in this sample, there wasn't fear. Doesn't mean that's not what we've encountered in other places. So the belief and meaning piece went to the decisions. The coping piece was with the practices and prayer. The community and relationships were very much a piece of it, and then there was prayer with regard to suffering too. Yeah, the community has been helpful. They've prayed with me, and I know a lot of them were praying for me. Relationships, I pray with my mom, thanking God for mom. I've been suffering. This man was talking about his wife, and she was suffering, and they have a prayer group from their community. I realized that those guys were just finishing up with their prayer session down there, and they must have been praying for her. Em had gotten up and taken a bath, got dressed, and swept the floor, and all of this happened by 8 o'clock. So he was crediting their prayer. Her ability to get through the day. Religious practices of liturgy were very restorative and important as well. Talked about here a man talking about his dad. No, he never missed church. He might have forgotten what he ate for lunch, but boy, he remembered every prayer and he always went. Father F. offered a great deal of support and read him his last rites and everything. Again, the liturgical and sacramental support. And the observation that mom does want to have a priest. Attendance, as long as possible, had been very important, and they did describe the role in that. I kept going to church, and I needed somebody else to drive me, and it seemed like I managed to get somebody to pick me up. Her social life was mostly to go to church every Sunday and participate in some of the church activities until she couldn't do it anymore. She stopped about 8 months ago. And then there were the visits, the importance of the community visits. She enjoyed when past okay. Spiritual pain, I'll just have to tell you, indeed it was there, and we can talk about it in the questions, it's in my conclusions. Faith and religious practices and end-stage renal disease was essential in decision-making. It was essential in coping, and it also caused pain.
Thank you, Barbara. If we're going to stay on time, we started late. We have 5 presentations. Donia is going to charge us if we don't get out of the room by 5 o'clock. So we may have time for one question or comment.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
What method did you use in the quantitative research?
It's really grounded research based in Strauss's theory from a long time ago in the 60s. We've all three been in and out of the dialysis unit for a long time. I as a chaplain, he as a physician, and she as a nurse. And so although none of us have actually lived the dialysis, we were using our historic base in that way for the grounded process, and then took threads from several of the others. We used Nudist as our thank you.
Yeah, great use of grounded theory for, as you described, actually an issue around which there's not a lot of good research, and so if we're going to begin to get familiar with it, talking to patients and families is just a great way to start. Good work. Hope you'll be writing it up and letting us know.
So
we started with the other presentation in order to keep going. Say your name, please. Yeah. And you're also one of our presenters, right?
It's Jimmy's internet. I think you don't have an internet. Because she had a kind of a program you need to download the credit called the.
Yes, right. Yeah.
But they couldn't download over there, and the girl is cold, but there is no connection here. What are you going to do? But there's a connection for this unit. Anyone knows? No, we have to download. We have internet at least for 5 minutes, at least. Or 10 minutes.
On his machine?
It doesn't matter. And it's just unique internet.
Download the unit.
Yeah, but there's no code that for this unit. The internet code is for some.
The gentleman.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, other friends can go on and I'll be able to figure out.
That'd be great, yeah. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Eve Couchard from Lausanne, did I say it right?
Yes, that's right.
Switzerland, part of the team that has developed this stress assessment tool, eager to hear about. No connection for you?
No, it's okay.
Good afternoon, everybody. So I am Eve Ribot-Toucher. I am a medical doctor working with the Foundation of Internistic and then Geriatrician. And I work at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland in the geriatric service. This presentation is part of a set, and my colleague Alda Wenig-Dust will present next to me. and also she's a psychologist. And also there is a third presentation on session 5 with our chaplain, Etienne Rocha. And we are part of the Swiss team that you talked yesterday.
Yeah.
Yes, and I will present you the instruments made to assess the spiritual distress we made. The plan of my presentation, I will speak of a geriatric patient's clinical history that is difficult for the health team to make a decision despite a multidimensionally taking of care. So then the spiritual distress is mentioned by the chaplain with this instrument, and then how we integrated it in our history. And we arrived to an ethical debate, and then it helps us to structure the discussion and to make a decision in this clinical history. So it's an old person admitted to hospital for dysphagia, cough, and recidivant pneumonia. So if we take the technical model and we make a different specific analysis, biologic, psychologic, sociologic, and spiritual analysis, how can I analyze this clinical history? So with the biological analysis, this is P, who is 93 years old. As I told, she has a decline in general health, CAS, and without improvement after treatment, she arrives to hospital with a big cachexia and dysphagia. She sees her ear and nose and throat, specialist, thank you. And he diagnoses a swallowing incoordination and reduced swallowing reflex, who can be as a differential diagnosis, either a presbyesophagus or a tumor. What we know about this patient, through the biological analysis, is she has not a lot of comorbidities. She had no hospitalization since 2005. She has chronic renal failure, you see her anemia, hearing loss, and she had a mastectomy. But actually, she has no current medication. The evolution in the next semester, we see rapidly that she cannot take any food or drink, no swallow any medication, so she has metabolic disorders and significant functional weakness. She expresses the wish to die with suicidal ideation. With this dysphagia, she has little chance of improvement, significant metabolic disorders. We made also a specific global geriatric assessment with cognitive and mood disorders and this suicidal ideation. The specialist proposal was either to place a nasogastric tube to feed her and to give her medication, or accompanying the patient at the death that would arrive in a few days because of the cachexia and electrolyte metabolic disorder. The problem with the patient is that she had no capacity of discernment concerning this clinical decision. So now, about psychological anamnesis, we know that she had no history of depression. At the start of the stage, you see she had sadness, anxiety, these suicidal thoughts, with no urgent consideration after the psychiatric clinical exam, and she can be quickly reassured that she keeps ambivalent and fluctuates. Sociologically, we know that she lives alone and she has one niece. She is independent for activities of daily living, and she needs help for the instrumental activities of daily living. She has small entourage, she rarely sees her doctors, and doesn't accept a lot of external aid. First, for the spiritual evaluation, she does not speak of religious belief, does not ask for a specific intervention of the chaplain. So, after 5 days, about since she arrived, we have a complex situation and we don't know what to do. It's not just one question with one problem to solve, but you see what is the autonomy of the patient, what is the project, Do we have to put this nagelogastric probe? What are the possible treatments? And she has no capacity of discernment. What to do? And we try to try the narrative approach through the story of the patient, how to nourish the different other anamnesis and dimensions, but it doesn't help us. So first, the technical model I showed you doesn't find answers and solutions acceptable for the team and for the patient. And the relational model show that we receive a lot of information, of diffuse information, depending which caregiver goes to the patient. So it doesn't help us to make a decision. We are in a dead end. We decided to integrate significant spiritual history in our integrated biopsychosocial and spiritual experimental approach. It integrates the spiritual dimension with the other dimension. We decided that spiritual dimension is part of the deep code of what makes the patient in the whole person. Our proposed conceptual representation of the spirituality is this current pattern you see on the right. The personal spiritual dimension does or does not include traditional religious resources. Our model, the spiritual needs model, is a model with four subdimensions with their corresponding needs on the right. That was already showed yesterday. The evaluation of the spiritual dimension is made by a trained chaplain. Then it is integrated in the other dimension through the interdisciplinary seminar and we make each week in our hospital. It can lead to an ethical decision, and then it helps us to construct a coordinated care plan. So, in this situation of Mrs. P, the patient was seen twice, and it shows spiritual disorders in all of the four subdimensions, especially in the value subdimension. At the second evaluation, because it was a complex story, disturbances also fluctuate, but the spiritual distress remains severe. And what the chaplains can tell us after this spiritual distress assessment tool, he can tell us that Mrs. P does not see how to reconstruct an overall life balance. And above all, she does not want to do it. And also that Mrs. P's spiritual dimension was not centered on the meaningful dimension, but on values. So it was important for her to tell us a story to discuss. And the chaplain recommended us to compare his results with the other data of the other members of the care team and to bring them into an ethical deliberation. We did an ethical debate with all the members of the team where autonomy of the patient, ambivalence with the question of putting this nasogastric tube or not, was on one hand, and on the other hand, the bad pronostic, the results of the stats, and maybe the question of comfort care with no nasogastric tube to put. And there was a certain emergency to do it because the patient was not going well. The objective of the debate is to attempt to reconstruct the presumed will of Mrs. P with the data generated by the spiritual evaluation. And as I said, it implicates all the interdisciplinary clinical care team. the results of the ethical debate, I don't go with the different things said in the debate, but we see that Mrs. P doesn't want to go on with living in this state. It's not possible for us to reconstruct the global life balance, and she certainly doesn't want to. Also, what was important, her relatives are of the same opinion, and they didn't have other constructive elements to come in this ethical debate. The decision then was taken by the whole team not to put another gastric tube and to do comfort care. And then we applied this decision by the medical responsible of the patient, and we informed the patient, the niece, and all the multidisciplinary team. And it made a real coherence in the care of the patient, with also a responsibility of each different member of the team who knows now how to be with the patient. The evaluation showed that Mrs. P dies a few days afterwards. And as a conclusion, what I can say is this, evaluation of spiritual disease distress showed improvement in the overall care of the patient. The care plan could be discussed more adequately, and there was also a better self-esteem of all the caregivers of the multidisciplinary team to take care of this patient. Now, thank you for your attention.
Thank you. We have time for a few questions or comments. Yeah, we do. So, as an ethicist, what do you think?
I have first a question that goes to exactly the ethics of it. In Switzerland, do you have an advanced directive, or what we know in the U.S.?
Yes. Yes, we have that. Not a lot of people really have this advanced decision in their region, or we don't have less than 10 persons have this decision taken. We try to promote this, but it's not often that they have.
Mm-hmm. Are they, if someone has said something, not written it down, but has said something before, is that taken in as part of the...
No, we must have something written with the date, and that's the first thing we must do when we receive a person at the hospital. Then we must see if he have a representant thérapeutique, a therapeutic representative, legal, or maybe he has chosen. And if not, we must the legal situation has changed last year, but we must really ask the family or the person who takes care of the patient. And we must implicate them in the discussion. If the patient cannot take, has no capacity of discernment.
And so there must be many circumstances like
Yes, very often, yes. Mm-hmm. And I must say, as a medical doctor, because I wanted to speak as how we could use this tool, this that tool, but as a clinical practitioner, it helps us to have more things to make a decision in the multidisciplinary team. So it's very often with old people, with dementia, with depression, and with delirium, that they don't have the capacity of discernment, and we must take a decision because they are in the hospital, they have medical problems, and it can be a plus.
Usually the physicians are making the decision and not the team.
So, yes, that was my, just I show you the, this figure, I didn't think, this is how hospital functions. The medical doctor is on the top and he must decide and he takes this responsibility. And we often use the ethical device to take a moment to discuss all together, or everyone can see, can I hear. And then we make a decision with
And then, okay, we come back to the institutional functionals, and with the medical doctor who take the responsibility, but then it's easier to be all of the, to know that everyone is behind us, I would say, than to take the decision alone.
Maybe time for one more comment about this. Anybody? One more, Barbara?
It represents a huge change, a very big culture change.
Mm-hmm. You know, we can do that in a certain assessment, a certain population. People, we have this multidisciplinary team, we have time sometimes, not always, absolutely. Of course.
Thank you very much. So next, we have Anne Bernie Durst, also from the Lausanne Hospital, and saying again about the critical distress assessment tool.
Oh, great.
Well done.
So, thanks to Professor Fitchett. So, I'm a psychologist and I'm working with Dr. Rupi. So, today I will speak to you about the role of a chaplain and a psychologist when we use this model as presented to you with a stat, which could cause problems between the psychologist and the chaplain. So, we are, you know, we make three presentations. So, I will just make a quick reminder about the spiritual distress assessment with a stat, and then I will expose you a complex case, first analyzed in a traditional way, and next within an integrated model of care, to show you how a chaplain and a psychologist will work together within this model. A quick reminder, a spiritual needs model, on the left, the five dimensions of spirituality and the corresponding needs on the right. And also, to remember, when the chaplain makes the assessment, three-stage process, the assessment, the integration of this assessment with the other dimension, and finally the construction of the coordinated care plan, which is very important for the chaplain and the psychologist for this case. So, the complex case, I present you Mrs. A. She's 66 years old. She's fully independent, despite suffering from Parkinson's disease since 6 years. However, since her husband's death, doctors disagree on a psychosis diagnosis. One day, Mrs. A falls, and she must undergo a complicated hip replacement, and after that, it's so complicated that she comes into a geriatric rehabilitation unit. On arrival in the unit, she's hypoactive, she hallucinates, she falls several times, and she's fully dependent. So, here we analyze the situation of Mrs. A in a traditional way. As I show you with the technical models, we would first make a biological assessment. It's the medical doctor, and the medical doctor would decide, in this case, to ask a psychologist or psychiatrist to make a psychological assessment, and he will forego the two other dimensions. So the biological dimension determines the other, and it's the medical doctor who decides which assessment we will go. With this technical model, the medical doctor says that the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease with what we in the US, we call it a delirium, I think. And the psychologist excludes psychosis, says it's a Parkinson's disease dementia with delirium, but also diagnoses an adjustment disorder with depressed mood. With this model, you will come to a plan of care which tells that we think a nursing home placement is the best solution, so as soon as possible. But there is a small problem. Mrs. A is so distressed that her care is compromised, fully compromised. She wants coverage, hallucinates more. It's very, very difficult. So, in our unit, we use for this situation the STAT, and we decided to make the assessment with the STAT. So, we use the interdisciplinary integrative model of care with technical specific anamnesis, which are all made by a specialist, but all specialists convene in our weekly meeting, and we decide together about a plan of care, a concerted plan of care, and afterwards we will carry on specific intervention. When we analyzed Mrs. A's situation, of course, the medical diagnosis is the same, but we made a social assessment and a social nurse found that Mrs. A had a very strong social network and she had a strong social support. The psychologist, the same diagnosis as before, of course, but next, the chaplain made an assessment, spiritual assessment of the spiritual distress with the STAT. And he found that the needs of sense and values were severely unmet, the need of identity was only partially unmet, and it's very important that the need of transcendence was covered. It was okay. What happens for a psychologist and a chaplain when they discover such a configuration? They don't argue, they come together, and we determine together which type of intervention should prevail. We could carry on a spiritual intervention only, or a psychological intervention only, or both only. We always decide together. So in Mrs. A's case, we decided first to compare their respective assessments and conclude that since her operation, Mrs. A struggles to maintain a sense of identity. And she also struggles to find resources to adapt to the new situation. So we decided to carry on a joint spiritual and psychological intervention. We worked together and for this special situation, we defined together the course of the intervention and we decided that I would focus on the psychological dimension of identity. It was very disturbed, but my colleague Etienne would work on the side dimension transcendence, which was very strong in this patient. So we carried on a joint intervention and I tried to help the patient to rebuild a sense of identity and Etienne reinforced the side dimension of transcendence with the patient. So we worked together to make up our psychological weakness and to reinforce a spiritual resource, which was it's quite rare, actually, to have a weakness and a resource. As a result, Mrs. A slowly recovered a certain sense of identity, and finally she accepted transfer in nursing home and cooperates fully to her care. For the team, it had huge benefits. It gave the team more options to design an adapted care plan, and we were able to explain to a patient what we wanted to do, and she could agree and cooperate. So, in conclusion, a structured interdisciplinary model of care using the STAT allows to differentiate spiritual from psychological distress, to design the most efficient intervention, spiritual only, psychological only, both. It also helps to propose a care plan making the most sense for the patient, for the health team, and for the family. And from the psychologist and chaplain's point of view, when psychological and spiritual distress coexist, chaplains and psychologist intervention make possible to address simultaneously the patient needs and to treat the patient as a whole person. So thank you very much.
Could you go to the slide that has the oval with the model? So it's at the very beginning. Right?
Yeah. Coming back?
Yeah. Well, I think there are there questions or comments?
In Switzerland, when you have interventions that are being coordinated between the chaplain and the psychologist, is there, how is the reimbursement? Who gets paid?
It's a little bit, it's a little bit special because it's in the hospital. In the hospital, we have a reimbursement, which is per case. Every pathology has a certain amount of money, which is allowed. And it's included in the overall cost.
And so she came in with a broken hip and has so much money for the broken hip?
That is...
In a sense, even where she is, if the team has a resident team, or we can choose who goes to the patient, and we receive a certain sum of money per day. In ambulatory, it would be
In Switzerland, psychologists are less reimbursed than a psychiatrist, for example. But in hospital, I'm paid by the service of geriatric medicine.
And the chaplain is also...
Right, but since everyone's on salary, they're not being billed for the number of hours they spend with separate patients. That's the advantage of national health, right? I'm sorry to cut you off.
That's just fine. Chaplain is also being
paid. That's right. So in the spiritual assessment, identity is actually a spiritual issue.
Yeah.
Right? A disturbance in identity is a spiritual issue. But in the care plan for this patient, identity was addressed by a psychologist.
Yes, because we found that identity was disturbed in both domains. It causes spiritual distress and psychological distress. But we found by discussing in depth the situation that the psychological disturbance on identity was much more important, and it was somehow to. So we decided to help Mrs. A on the psychological level, and we found it would be more effective for Etienne, the chaplain, to work on something which was very solid on. It was.
The transcendence.
Yes, the transcendence to help her to rebuild this identity, but to combine both. We found that Etienne wouldn't work on the identity from a spiritual point of view. It would be less efficient. But it was a choice. We discussed. It's exactly the discussion we have. I told him I found a strong disturbance on the identity. He told me too. And I said, okay, but on which level? And we discussed, and we said, okay, it would be better to do that. We designed the intervention.
That was just my question. Number one, how did you assess the loss of identity at what level? And number two, what was the intervention? How did you measure that you actually rebuild the identity was rebuilt?
As a psychologist? Or a chaplain? I would say from a very simple way, a certain sense of coherence. Mrs. A was very independent. Before the accident, she was very independent. She was quite well, and in one night she became dependent, she hallucinated, she didn't recognize herself, she didn't recognize her family. So she told me, every time I went to see her, I don't know who I am. I don't know who I am. After the intervention, when I entered the room, I asked her, "Who are you?" And she said, "I'm Mrs. A. I'm not happy, but I'm Mrs. A." And it's very progressive. You must work. It was a week-long work, but it worked. I saw her recently on the nursing home. She recognized me, and she is quite well for the problem she has. And she's relatively happy now, and she knows who she is. But it's very fragile, the sense of identity, I agree with you.
Maybe there's time for one other comment or question. I would have to say that the level of cooperation between the chaplain and the team that you describe is about as high as any that we ever see in the States that I'm familiar with. That the way in which the chaplain's assessment is integrated into the team is really quite impressive. Many chaplains would feel far less integrated, their assessments were more marginal. And I assume in part that's related to the skill, it's in part related to the multidisciplinary, the openness of the various members of your team, and your respect for this assessment tool that you've developed together. Actually, this is what gives the chaplain a kind of authority to contribute.
But also that the chaplain then comes to the medical doctor or the emergency medicine with practical
recommendation.
Yes, with a plan of care.
Yes.
That makes sense for me as a doctor.
We design that. Yeah.
And that's very important.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We design it all together.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Good. Thank you so much.
Dr. Corey?
Yes, I'm sorry we skipped you before, but I think it made sense to put the two Swiss projects together.
I'm going to sit down for a second.
Yeah. It's your turn. Have a seat.
Pardon? Okay.
Which one is yours? Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Okay.
Look at that. That's wonderful.
Okay.
Have you been
successful? Oh, okay. The move is here somewhere,
surely. Yeah, please introduce yourself and tell us what you
know. I'm Dagmar Corrie. I'm a psychologist, a researcher, and lecturer, and I'm affiliated with the University of Ulster, specifically the Bamford Centre for Mental Health and Wellbeing there. That's been there since late 2012. And I'm also very much affiliated with the university. Yes, and I feel slightly misplaced in this group. I'm not entirely sure why I'm here, so I hope you bear with me if it doesn't ring a direct bell with you. But hopefully I won't bore you to death entirely. So I want to talk to you today about the creativity strategy construct and role in transformative coping. This has actually been published, as you can see, that last year. And if somebody wants a copy, I have a copy. Might get me. Sorry about that. But just a little reminder, since it's transformative coping and it's a new theory, and obviously butterflies in some way, you couldn't find a better symbol for transformation. That is one reason. There's also a more personal reason to that, but I won't go into that right now due to time constraints. So just a little bit of a background as to why, you know, you might ask yourself, why would you do that? Why would you come up with a new theory pertaining to transformative coping? Well, the reason is very much in line with what we have heard over the last couple of days, as in how much of a negative effect stress and negative emotions can have
on not only mental health, but obviously physical health as well. So the idea is to find or enable people to draw on their personal resources, use the personal strengths as an effective coping tool. So that was the idea behind it. Managing emotions is very much within that area. And we know that emotional suppression can, of course, be very detrimental to our well-being. So becoming aware of those emotions and being able to express them in a good way and transform the negative ones into positive ones, that lies behind that idea. So positive responses to stress and building personal strengths. Of course, as you can see, there's a lot of positive psychology in that idea. So then what was the aim of the study? Just to give you a brief overview. We know from the literature that both creativity and spirituality have individually, in their own right, great benefits to mental health. And from a theoretical viewpoint, many studies have shown also, papers have shown that there's a theoretical link between those two, but it hasn't actually been looked at from an empirical standpoint today. So that was the idea. So, linking creativity and spirituality as a construct and applying it proactively as a coping strategy, that is the idea, leading to positive transformation, increasing resilience and therefore long-term coping, protecting mental health, promoting mental health. So a number of aims. First of all, is creativity used in coping by the sample that we used? Is spirituality used in coping? Are these two distinct concepts related? And to what extent are they related? Do they apply them in conjunction? And does this happen irrespective of demographic variables? So that was what we were trying to look at. And in the process, we were validating these two new scales, creative coping scale and the spiritual coping scale, respectively. Okay, just very quickly, I'm sure you all, well, maybe not much of creativity, but you will be aware of the benefits of spirituality. Creativity, again, I could go on, there's much literature on that, as you may imagine, but I've just chosen a couple of references, a couple of papers. Madden and Bloom, for example, listed improved expression and communication, integration of emotional, physical, cognitive and social functioning, so again very much to do with identity, talking about identity, enhanced self-awareness and facilitating positive transformation. And then another study here found increased meaning and purpose in life, self-expression, relaxing and focusing, increased hope, self-esteem and reduction in self-harm. And crucially, of course, those benefits have been found to extend also to those with physical illness. Notably, there's a lot of research on cancer patients and how it impacts on them, on their well-being. So that's the creativity side of it. And then looking at the spirituality side of it, again, more familiar with that. So change perspective, transcending adverse circumstances, reconnecting with yourself, with others, with nature, God or higher power, which would kind of feed into the next bit, which is all about connectedness and belonging. I think it was Professor Koenig mentioning attachment yesterday, so that would very much fit in with that concept. Regaining hope and self-esteem, of course, and both of those have also been individually shown to have a great positive impact on mental health. Transformation and personal growth. Meaning in life, one of the core elements again. Fallon Hills came up with the spiritual theory of self, which is again very much about positive transformation and building resilience as fundamental processes in coping with major life changes. And then, again, the notion that these benefits are universal, although they are, of course, influenced by culture, as we know, and society, they are nevertheless universal. So then we come to the link. So as I said, no empirical studies to date to see, you know, is there a link and how does it work and how can we test it. So that was the idea. Number 30 of publications suggesting a link, and whenever that link is suggested, And I have to say, also I found that in a different study that was part of this whole scientific, like, which was more qualitative, and again, people would have said the same sort of thing. So creativity is most often regarded as an aspect of spirituality, which makes sense when you think about, again, what we heard about at the weekend, that spirituality is the essence of a human being. So if it's the essence, then creativity can express that essence as a means of self-expression and emotional expression, and often very helpful when people are not able to verbalize their distress. Edwards called it the via creativa, so the spiritual journey. And of course, the ever-present subjective meaning, so that is the link that suggests the two, connect the two as well. So the more meaningful something is to someone, the more spiritual sacred it is. Okay. So just quickly then, the theory of transformative coping, and in fact there's another paper, I have a copy of that has recently been published, and that describes that whole theory in detail, and has in fact the model in it, because there's a model that goes with it. So I wrote the theory really in Lazarus and Folkman's stress and coping model. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that. And Fredrickson's broaden and build theory of positive emotions. So these are the two pillars, if you like. To that end, you get it involves emotion-focused and problem-focused coping. And it also involves building and increasing resilience through the increasing of positive and decreasing of negative emotions. Okay, so from the spiritual side then, that encourages reflection and increases self-awareness, and creativity affords the opportunity for emotional expression. So it's a question of going inwards and moving outwards. Right, and the whole idea is that it works as a positive, proactive coping strategy that can work at any point in life. People can have access to it at any point in life because it's, we all have the potential to be creative and be spiritual. And you can talk about a creative attitude and a spiritual attitude, a way of being, a way of life, and that can be nurtured and can be fostered. And looking at each individual benefits, if we can combine them, then these benefits would be amplified and lead to more effective long-term coping, and therefore improved well-being and resilience. So the creation of the scales, again, the literature was searched for useful instruments. And there's, of course, a plethora of instruments that measure creativity and measure spirituality respectively. We wanted to look specifically at creative coping and spiritual coping, and very much as to, from a subjective point of view, what it means to people, how it feels to people, what it does for people. So therefore, the two new instruments, and just, I'm sure you're familiar with all of these, so just a quick overview of these scales and how they would be distinct from this particular scale that is now the spirit coping scale. Okay. Methods then, so we had 610 students, most were between 18 and 30. So it was only one older participant, and then you had quite a few more females than males, and in this particular sample, the majority was from Kuwait, just over half of them, and then Irish, British, American, and four various other ones, and of course, yeah, almost by definition, again, 54 were Muslims, 38 Christians, and then some others. Briefly again, the questionnaire booklet, of course, there were demographic questions, and then you had the initial creative coping scale, and the spiritual coping scale. Okay, so I won't go into it, but as I say, if you want a handout, I have handouts, you can take them with you. Yeah, same thing here. Get to the point. Quickly, yeah, in the end, we ended up actually for both scales with a single factor model. Both of them had good internal consistency, which we're very pleased about. So I'm hoping somebody else will apply them in different research to test them. And Yeah, frequency correlations at 73% percent of participants applied creative coping to some extent, so between moderately and strongly agree. And it's a similar story for the spiritual side of it, although there was 51% said they apply spiritual coping. And again, we had a single factor model, and the items were reduced, suitably reduced. Okay, so overall we had a moderate positive correlation between the two scales. This correlation was significant for females in the age group 1 and strongest within the Kuwaiti Muslim subsample. And as far as gender is concerned, the accounted for 6% of the variance in the creative coping scale and 2%, which I guess isn't very much, in the speed of coping scale. Okay, what was that? No difference in the creative coping scale for age, but there was, even though small effect size, a significant difference on the spiritual coping scale for age, with the younger ones scoring higher than the older ones. And we had the same thing for religion and nationality. On both scales, there was a significant difference in that the Kuwaitis and the Muslims scored significantly higher than the Christians and the British and Irish. Okay, now, as far as the scales go, they show promising psychological properties, so that's hopeful that they're ready to use for whoever feels that way inclined. We found that the majority of participants applied both creativity and spirituality in coping, and a very high percentage for creativity there. And we also found a positive association between the two scales. So that would support the theory. What we want to do is basically look further at the demographic differences, because the sample was quite skewed. So that has to be tested further. I mean, the poster we put up earlier actually reports on a different sample and reports on the confirmative factor analysis, and that is in the process of being published now. So again, very much the recommendation would be to test the whole thing further, and in fact to have a copy of the basic model that goes with that, and that would require further testing and more in-depth testing as well. This is my last slide. Recommendations then. So the whole idea behind devising that theory is that hopefully we can devise an intervention, and that will actually help people and be put to good use. So the suggestion is that to have a spiritual attitude and creative expression can be cultivated. Some people know how to do that, they know how to resort to their own inherent resources. Others can't, but that can be fostered and encouraged. And it can find application in mental health promotion, in prevention, in therapy, and in recovery. And it can be applied standalone on your own, of course. So it's empowering, and it's a problem-solving and emotion management tool. And that is really it. I mean, somebody builds resilience, buffers against stress, helping to improve and maintain mental health and well-being. That is the crux of the matter, but that, again, needs more testing.
Well done. You and your colleagues have done an immense amount of work. Time is getting shorter and shorter, so maybe time for one comment or question.
Nobody is. I was just looking at me.
I just want a question.
Please, yeah.
I'm curious about kind of not spirituality, but creativity. What did you mean about this notion, style of living, or inner creation, or organizational creation, or artistic creation, or all in one?
Do you mean how do I define creativity?
Yeah.
Oh, how long have you got? But for the purpose of the study, it wasn't defined as eminent creativity. Whereas what some, say for example, Teresa Abelhard would have said, everyday creativity.
Okay.
So it's something that everybody can do, everybody's capable of. So we're not all of us are Van Goghs, but we can you can cook, you can bake, you can draw, you can maybe paint, you can do piece of music, whatever it is, whatever your inclination is and your passion is. Just resort to that. Just express yourself in whichever way you feel compelled and you feel that feels natural to you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the notion of transformative coping in the world of the spirituality and creativity together, I'm eager to learn more and to see your papers. It sounds very good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and tell us about your work.
I'm Ayşe Burcu Gören, from Turkey, from Ankara University. I'm a PhD student, and this presentation, this issue is part of my PhD. And Alice Makatodo is my partner in this project. The project is about spirituality in people with Down syndrome. In our project, we want to explore the role of spirituality in the lives of people with Down syndrome and their parents in Turkey. For this, an 8-week-long spiritual care program was conducted with 6 young people with Down syndrome living in Ankara, aged between 16 and 26 years old. At first, in-depth interviews were conducted with mothers, basic information about their children's personality, vulnerability, moods, emotionality, daily routines, their expectations, and what makes them happy or unhappy was collected. Secondly, a weekly program was planned. Its main objective was to add spiritual activities in the daily routines of the DS teenagers. DS means Down syndrome, you know. Considering the Islamic nature of the local culture, the following activities were selected. Charity bazaar, we made a kermes with the Down syndrome youth. And the Friday sermon speech, and helping the poor, visiting the elderly at a nursing home. May concert, modeling workshop, talking about France, universe, heaven and God, visiting worship houses, and as a result, as expected, mothers reported increased happiness, sense of meaning, sense of belonging, sense of being helpful, and boosting self-esteem in their children. In this presentation, we will report some findings from the project. We observed 4 main changes in the following domains. Firstly, self-perception of individuals with Down syndrome, and secondly, family's perception of their children with Down syndrome, and third, social perceptions of people with Down syndrome, and last, perception and attitude of education of us. But I guess my time is not enough for both of them. I prepared all of them in this series, but I prefer the first and the last one to you. And the first one, self-perception of individuals with Down syndrome. One of the exciting and promising results of our program was the observable positive change in self-worth perceptions of the Down syndrome youth, socially, emotionally, and spiritually. And social positive self-worth perception, firstly, managing. As a part of the program, we organized a charity bazaar, and they prepared some foods by themselves, and they sold by themselves in the kermes. We talk about the poor people having lots of needs, poor children, and we decided together to help them, to buy them, to prepare for them some goods. We done this kermes. With this event, Down syndrome youth were given an opportunity to the active producers of an activity, offering some service and helping others change their perception of self-worth. These are some photos. We bought some goods and give them together. They were giving instead of systemic assistance with this project. And we standing out, one of the Down syndrome youth participants was given an opportunity to deliver a speech during the Friday sermon in Altında, Ankara, in front of almost 1,000 people. This is the part of the mosque. And a video, a mini part of his speech. He's talking about brotherhood. All of the human beings are brothers, and this mosque is all of us. And we are brothers in here. We love each other. We love you. And this day is 21st day of the March, World Down Syndrome Day. This day. And he talked about that. We visited you and we came here to meet you. And this is our day, and we are together with you in here, he said. And it's so important for us because it's historically in Islam. The first time a mental disabled person stands next to an imam assuring the service. And in this project we have an opportunity to be on air. Two other Down syndrome persons were hosted on two national TV programs. They spoke about the project and their feelings about it. They mentioned the friendship they developed and the common praying with other Down syndrome persons and the worshiping community. These are the videos about it. I'm very happy. I love Quran. We thank him. We thank him. It was wonderful. It was super. He says. We make friendships. I love them. I love Burcu, me, and the other sisters, Özgür. I love all of you. I am very happy to be in here. And our days are very well in this project. And we are studying for a concert, ilahi concert. It's our working session. And another. She is talking about her new friend, her names, their names, she's talking about. We made a very nice, very good, very strong friendship, she's talking about it. Mm-hmm. talking about before the project. I was sitting at home and watching TV and eating just all my day. She's talking about that. Okay. And the producing during the melding workshop, every participant produced an Ebru painting for themselves. It's their Ebru. And we made from these Ebru's a bookmark. And at the end of our project, we give a concert. And at the end of the concert, they gave their presents to the guests. And second, emotional perspective perception. Compared to their peers, the Down syndrome teenagers felt too childish and were eager to develop more mature behaviors. Mother supported that. They changed some of their habits and kept them after the program. For instance, one day Sevinur, a Down syndrome participant, opened the fridge and took her food by herself. Another Down syndrome participant, Eda, started to sleep in her own room on her own initiative. And Ömer's mother reported that he became assertive. He behaved like a man, she says. He started to make rules, care for and feel responsible for others. He wanted to know where his mother had been without informing him beforehand. Our photos. And spiritual positive self-worth perception. Transcendency. The Meyhane is a place Ney is a reed flute, maybe you know. It has a transcendent voice. We had an experience in Meyhane. They expressed so much, he says, I felt melancholy. And connectedness. We had a religious chant concert, and at the concert, yearning, our chant about yearning and longing for perfect Muhammad. We are in mosque for prayer. Eda is praying. And it's a very interesting experience. It's a very spiritual experience for Gökhan. In there, we are in the ilahi concert for longing Prophet Muhammad, and his hymn is about it, and he's very feeling spiritual. this theme is about missing and longing Prophet Muhammad. How's the time? Over?
2 minutes.
Okay. So long.
What we think about the project, what we learned. Caregivers' perceptions of individuals with Down syndrome. Many research indicates that variable social roles, relationships, activities, and having choice and independence make people with learning disabilities happy and satisfied. During the project, we realized that Down syndrome are not needy people, but they have the same needs as anybody else, as we all do. In our case, this youth has the same expectations as any other teenager. The project comes to fill in some void areas in the DS youth's lives. What do they need? We think they need to be given the opportunity to live the things anybody would need to live a healthy life mentally and spiritually to achieve self-realization. As caregivers, we identified three specific needs during the 8-week program: respect instead of assistance, mutual relationship and friendship, recognition of individual differences. And I'm passing all of these. And relationships, their friendships. Serena says, now I have friends. When they talk, I listen to them, and they listen to me when I talk. It's very important for her. Furthermore, parents told us that now some of the DS youth plan to invite their friends to their home and request it for them to make some preparations. I'm passing all of this. It's so important for me. After this AC program, one of the learning outcomes for us was to realize that these youth need mutual treatment, mutual friendship. They don't like to be treated less as a caregiver. When I started to treat them as a mutual friend, I witnessed how they became happy and sad.
Maybe that was the final word, right? Okay.
No.
I think maybe we're finished. Congratulations. Very, very interesting project. I think we have time maybe for one question or comment.
I would just observe we've heard research, we've heard theory, we've now seen intervention.
I'm afraid we have to adjourn and stay on our schedule. It's very exciting, a rich selection of projects. Best wishes to all of you and your continued research.
Thank you.